our next class, or the first real class of today, is the necessity of death. And we'll kind of look at how you have to die before you can become a miniature god. It's just how life is. You gotta die. So I think one of the key things that makes death something that people fixate on is the sort of immutable nature of it. Like, not so much the idea like, oh, when I die, maybe I won't exist anymore. What's going to happen? I don't know what it is. The unknown definitely terrifies people, but it doesn't always fascinate them. But death is like the one thing that is pretty much unchanging. Like, everything else in life you can kind of get around or find ways to negotiate. And it's something that kind of is pretty changeable. But death is like the clearest example of a permanent and constant that's going to touch everyone. I mean, there's also light, but no one thinks of light that way. With the death tarot card, ironically, it has to do with change, though. And so you have this immutable thing that is the ultimate change for everything that it touches. When you apply death to anything, it's like one of the biggest changes that thing goes through. But death itself remains the same throughout. It's like there's no sympathy, there's no exchange, no sharing with death. It just comes and says, this is how it is. And so that's a pretty foreign and different thing from what most people experience with anything else they experience in life. So as a result of kind of this epicness of the idea of death, a lot of people assume that death is what inspires people to create religion. That you have this fear and this sorrow related to the idea of dying and the idea of experiencing people around you dying, and so religion develops as a way of creating a good, happy feeling around it, or giving you some catharsis in dealing with it, so that it doesn't have to seem like this horrible end. It's just the next thing that happens. And so it takes away a little bit of the terror, because you can start to think that you know what's going to happen afterwards. And it takes away a little of the extremity, because it becomes a little bit more of an exchange. Like, yeah, you're going to die, but you're going to get this thing out of it. You're going to get to go to paradise. You're going to get to go live again as somebody else, or whatever it is that the particular religion decides you're going to do. And so, I mean, it's a reasonable argument that religion is an answer to the fear of death and the epic hugeness of death. But there are a lot of religions where death isn't really the focus on them. A lot of religions deal a lot with what you're doing in life, with the way the universe is set up in a general sense, and death is just part of what the religion deals with. We definitely do see some where the afterlife is definitely the main focus of it, but if you look at a lot of traditional religions, and by traditional I mean like pre-globalizing religions, so before Christianity, before Buddhism, before Islam, like, if you look at Judaism, you would think that there would be a really clear view of death in Judaism, but there's not. There are multiple different interpretations of death in Judaism, and all of them are considered acceptable. It's just not the focus. They don't care about it. It's how you live your life, and if you're living in accordance with the law. Hinduism, people in the West get kind of caught up in the whole idea of reincarnation, and the karma and dharma definitely play into the idea of reincarnation, but there's also a lot in Hinduism about how you live your life, how you celebrate things in your life, and death is just a part of the overall spectrum of everything else. A lot of contemporary paganism is very focused on death, and a lot of the pagan mystery traditions were very focused on death, but a lot of the traditional day-to-day pagan religions were not so death-oriented. They were about having a community that lived together in a way in which people were able to exchange with each other and kind of live together as a whole. So the argument that death is the impetus behind religion kind of falls short when you start looking at a lot of the earlier religions. it's later on, as mystery traditions start becoming religions, that we start seeing more of this focus on death. And as that starts to happen, you almost get this idea where you're living just to die. Like, it's not that you're living for your life or living because there's something that you're trying to do in life. You're living just as a way of waiting until you go, or making sure that you're going to die in a good way and go someplace good when you die. You get this idea that death is the admission to paradise, and so paradise is going to be so much better than anything that you have in life, so why get caught up in the stuff in life when you're going to go die and do this better thing for all of eternity? Or that death is a way to be free from all of the troubles and toils in life, and so you should just anticipate that and not worry about all the crap that's happening. And then there's the idea that if you fixate yourself on the idea of dying and being ready to die, then you could ignore everything that happens in life, so you won't be tempted to do evil and bad things that are going to mess up your good time when you die. Like, it's not, in my mind, a very healthy or fulfilling way to live. Like, if you assume that there is a personal God, a being that said, I'm going to create mankind and I'm going to have these rules for mankind, it would be kind of almost stupid to create a whole world, really a whole universe, and create all kinds of different life. And the whole point of that life is a game in which they have to figure out whether or not you're there and what the rules are and live according to those rules, or you're going to punish and destroy them for all of eternity if they don't get it figured out in the next 40 to 80 years. Like, it's a really ridiculous proposition when you look at it. Yes, maybe Descartes was right, and the evil genius actually did create the universe, and 1 + 1 really does equal 3, and we're all going to go to hell because we didn't figure it out. The point of this isn't really to get into like whether or not a given religion sucks and you should be another religion, but really mostly just to look at death. So aside from this idea of living for death, there are definitely healthy ways where you can have a religious structure that focuses on the afterlife. If you look at the classical mystery traditions, and really just about every mystery tradition that comes after those, death becomes a very important feature. Now, a lot of them also look at other features than just death, but some of them do focus almost exclusively on death. But the idea isn't that, okay, now that you're an initiate of the mysteries, you can focus on dying and you don't have to pay attention to the rest of your life, or you should just hate the rest of your life because it's not as good as dying and going to the underworld. It's more that you engage in the mystery tradition because it ensures a good death for you, not because death then overtakes your life. One of the classical views of death, and by classical here I do actually mean like big C classical, like the Greek and Roman mystery traditions, is that if you are not an initiate and you die, then your soul rots and is basically destroyed. The idea there, like a lot of people kind of think of it as just like you've got this big pile of soul shit in Tartarus and it's just there rotting forever. I think a more clear way to look at it is that kind of like in Judaism where God destroys the angels at the end of the day and makes new angels. He destroys the angels in a pool of fire, then from the same pool of fire makes the new angels. So the angels are basically recycled over and over again. The same thing with souls that of the uninitiated. The idea is more that they rot and are recombined into a base soul material, and then new souls are made from that until the souls become initiates and then they continue. Yes. That I think I picked up in that other thing that I mentioned to you. Yeah. And I'm pretty sure I'd seen it elsewhere before, but that was the big place where it kind of clicked for me. And so I could try to find out from them where they got the research, but I don't really talk to them anymore. And but so that you get this idea that initiation and death kind of tie together, and that's why it's important to go through the mystery traditions, because in going through the mystery traditions you learn either the customs of the afterlife or how to enter into the afterlife, and what the nature of death is, so that you can survive it without being destroyed in the process. And so in that sense, initiation is a way of providing immortality of the soul. And in some of those systems, it's provided through reincarnation, and in others, it's admission to better parts of the afterlife, where you don't rot. Now, the typical way that death is kind of viewed by the uninitiated is one in which death is what's immutable, but then by the initiated, the soul is what becomes immutable. Death is still there, but death becomes significantly less relevant, because you die, and in dying realize that the essence that is the actual you is what is actually unchanging. And you can kind of see this in a lot of the mythology related to the mystery traditions. With the mysteries of Eleusis, you have the story of Persephone, who goes down into the underworld, but comes back for part of the year and then returns to the underworld. With Orpheus, you have Orpheus entering the underworld and then coming back from the underworld. And then the same with Adonis. Adonis spends part of the year with Persephone in the underworld and part of the year with Venus in Olympus. And, or I guess with Aphrodite, if it's Persephone. So there's this idea that the soul is preserved against oblivion, but also that the soul is able to move back and forth between the living and the dead, because it has gained this preservation against oblivion. Now, in those stories, like, one of the general assumptions that people have is like, oh, well, those stories don't really apply to the mysteries, because it's all gods and half-gods that can move back and forth between the world and the living and the dead. Like Aeneas, for example, while there's not a clear mystery tradition around him, he does make a journey to the underworld and comes back. Same with Hercules, although there was a Herculean mystery tradition also. With those characters, they're half-gods, so they're able to do that. But Adonis is not a half-god. Adonis is human. And so he is the clearest example of a human being able to be taken into the mysteries and gain this same ability to move back and forth. But we're not doing the ancient Greek mysteries. We're not going to go out into the middle of nowhere and all die in that way. So looking at the contemporary mystery traditions, they have a lot more of a clear resurrection set up. Like in the Greek ones, you have this, well, we'll go in and we'll come out, but no one actually dies to go in. They enter in another way, which does fit a little bit more with what you do in the mystery traditions, because you're not actually killed. You go through a symbolic death. Maybe. But so Christianity is one of the easiest examples to look at as far as modern mystery traditions or contemporary mystery traditions, even though people don't tend to think of it as such, because it's kind of one of the first big mystery traditions to become a religion. So the first question you would ask in looking at Christianity is whether or not it communicates the mysteries and how it does so. In Catholicism, that is largely the intention of the Eucharist. If you've ever been to a Catholic Mass, you will know that before the Eucharist is consecrated, you proclaim the mysteries of faith. Christ has died, Christ has risen, Christ will come again. So the whole mystery that is being tied up in the Eucharist is this mystery of death and resurrection. In the Gospel of John, it explains that when the Eucharist is consecrated, the Holy Spirit comes upon the Eucharist and gives eternal life to those who eat it. Very clear example of what transubstantiation actually is. There's also communication through the Stations of the Cross, in which Catholics undergo the process of the crucifixion, but the resurrection is only really hinted at in the Stations of the Cross. So it's almost like you get all the death, but none of the mystery of survival. All in all, I find them kind of a clumsy way of communicating it. The mysteries are clearly present, but it's not automatic. It doesn't seem like everyone that goes through Stations of the Cross and the Mass becomes an initiate of the mysteries. You have to actually like engage in what's going on with them in a clear and intentional sense. Even a lot of priests will say that, yes, you get a lot of priests that are mystics who get into those things and really become like initiates of the Catholic mysteries through their work with them, but that even your average priest doesn't do that, let alone your average congregant. But their mysteries come with the promise of eternal life in paradise, or if you fall short of them, eternal damnation. They are predicated by living a life that's based in Christian dogma, which is not actually the way it's set up in the Bible. In the Bible, it is just you eat the bread and drink the wine, you live forever. But the church tradition is that you have to do all these other things as well. So it kind of almost undercuts the sense of the effectiveness of their mysteries, that they aren't able to fully communicate the mysteries, so you have to live a good life and hope that grace comes and saves you because the mysteries aren't going to. There's also not really a mastery of death in their mystery system. Their mysteries are entirely dependent upon somebody else coming in, mastering death for you, and taking you along for the ride. Now, Masonry, which is another pretty mainstream thing, I think gets a little bit better. You have the slaying of Hiram Abiff. And so, for anyone who is a Mason here, I apologize. But I myself am not one, so I am free to discuss this. And we just will expect that you will neither confirm nor deny anything I say. Okay. So, the Master Mason is killed because he won't reveal the secret word of the Master Mason to the workers who want the secret word. He goes through, and there are three workers that approach him and demand that he gives them the word, and each one slays him. But he remains ardent in not revealing the word because only the king and the Master Mason are allowed to have the word. So as a reward for protecting the secret, he is raised back to life by King Solomon and truly becomes a Master Mason at that point. So for him, the power and mastery of death comes from the mastery of the secret. The secret itself relates to the power and endurance of the soul. And by understanding that and keeping that to himself, he's able to preserve that power for himself so that he can conquer death and survive it. And survive it through the process of resurrection specifically. In his case, it is not a question of being able to move between life and death. He doesn't go back and forth between this world and the underworld like in the Greek mysteries. But he gains the ability to conquer adversity. Because he has conquered the immutable, he can then conquer anything else that is changing. So the benefit to him is that he is able to move beyond anything that comes to him because he recognizes that he has the power of being the immutable force himself, so no other force can overtake him. In Wicca, you have the same sort of mystery going on, but it's kind of mired in a whole bunch of other things. The Descent of the Goddess is all about this process of gaining power through dying and resurrecting oneself. The god in Wicca moves back and forth between life and death naturally, just like a lot of other classic mystery figures. He dies each year and comes back each year, and there's no real question for him in doing this. The goddess, however, doesn't die. She just remains until she decides that she has to chase after the god, and she goes into the underworld in a fashion mimicking the story of Inanna and her descent. She's stripped of all of her regalia, everything that shows that she's the goddess and queen over nature and everything. And then she goes into the underworld and is whipped by the Lord of the Dead. It's then revealed through him whipping her that he is the form that the god takes on when he dies. And in allowing herself to be whipped by him and gaining that knowledge of his consistency, she gains the power of magic and is able to go back up into the world and bring life back into the world by rebirthing the god, as that process is his new conception. Yes, because Gardner was into that. And so she's able to bring life back to the world through the darkness of winter, because it is in that darkness that she comprehends life and therefore conceives life. The process there is largely an illustration of their view and method of how magic works. If you look at a traditional Wiccan circle, the goddess is invoked before the god, because the goddess has to receive the god in order for magic to occur. She is the substance on which the god writes his force, which is the process that's undergone by the whipping. So the actual mystery of life and death is not a particular focus in that tradition, even though you're still initiated into that same mystery. Now, the actual mystery of death relates to the idea that when conquered, like I said, with dealing with masonry, you reveal that your soul is just as immutable as death is. You basically, in dying, take on, or in dying correctly, take on the same power and force that death has itself, and are therefore able to triumph over it. In the process, though, the reason that you're able to endure is because everything that is changeable and not constant in yourself, or not truly yourself, is destroyed through the process. So it's much like alchemy, in which you take a substance and you putrefy and decay the substance in order to remove out what it is that's not supposed to be there, and reveal what the actual true substance is. So it's like that process of calcination that we talked about yesterday, where you're destroying all of the lesser parts of a substance for the true part of the substance. In certain forms of alchemy, as opposed to just burning the thing, you allow other processes of decay to occur, like fermentation to reveal the mercury, rotting or putrefaction to reveal certain types of sulfur, particularly in animal alchemy. And so it's when you do that, the whole point is that in watching something decay, you're reflecting on all of those weak and unnecessary parts of yourself that you allow to decay, and in doing so are able to find what it is that is intended to survive in you, what it is that's the actual you, that gives you power and strength. So in life, being able to allow things to decay and look for the constant within the decay is the ability to detach oneself from a situation. If you look at Ercole Quadrelli's Knowledge of the Waters, I can't remember what name he wrote that under. Do you remember, Christian, the magical name he used? Abrasax, yeah. Frederick Abrasax. He talks about how the magician gains power by being able to remove himself from the myriad of forces that swirl through and influence the world, and stand above them so that he can then direct the forces. The Kabbalion talks about this same concept in the sense of controlling rhythms and movements so that you are able to move above the base level of the sway of forces, and therefore control how the forces affect you and how the forces beneath you move. And that, after a given point, is largely the way in which a magician gains control over things. Whether they're magical things or things in life. If you allow yourself to be fully swayed by all of the emotional currents, all of the influences of other people, all of the things in the media, you have no power. Everything else has power over you. By allowing yourself to take on the sensibility of death and recognize that all of that is impermanent and changing and unnecessary, you can move yourself outside of those influences so that they do not have to affect you in the sense of your emotions and your mind. And then you can rationally, using your core being and your core self, to determine how a situation should be handled and how you should cause that situation to go, giving you the ability to pretty much take on all comers. In terms of spiritual development, this prepares for the influx of the soul. Anytime you are destroying all of the false pieces of material, that's what you're doing, is you're preparing the material so that you have this essential base material which can hold and contain the actual true essence of the thing. Just like how we talked about yesterday, the corrupt buckets on the Tree of Life that couldn't hold the light. When you are destroying all of the corruption in a thing, you are preparing the thing to be able to hold that light. So in dying, you are preparing yourself, or what's left in yourself after the death, to be revived by the light of your soul. So how do you die? Well, the easiest way is to take a gun and put it... No, I'm kidding.
Actually, that's not that easy.
Yeah, I know. Yes. You just get someone else to do it for you. You use someone you don't like.
I guess the other side of the question is like the French term, le petit mort.
That we're going to get to that.
Okay.
So death can be achieved through initiation and meditation and reflection. It can also be achieved through experience. Achieving it through meditation or reflection or initiation should be pretty straightforward. You go through an initiation in which you invoke the forces of death and mimic the process of death and have things that teach you about what death is and what the mysteries of death are. Through meditation, you do things like what we just did with calling upon forces related to death, reflecting on ideas related to death and the mysteries thereof, scrying things that access into the forces related to death, so that you can reflect upon their nature, and in that reflection imbue yourself with those forces to the level at which you begin to understand them more fully and your being is changed by them. Through experience, you can do it through conquering a traumatic experience in the correct fashion. Now, you can have something traumatic happen to you where you survive the thing, and you get through it and you're able to deal with it and be okay. That's not necessarily the same thing as conquering the experience. You could even have something where you have something that's traumatic that happens and you're able to work to make things come out in a way that's beneficial for you, but that still won't necessarily teach you these lessons. If you approach it in a way in which you begin to recognize and analyze everything that's in the experience and rise above all that to where you're separated from it and unaffected by it, and from there are able to defeat whatever it is that's trying to defeat you, then you can basically create this sort of initiation through experiences that you undergo in your life. Now, this concept of death, and this gets to Lance's question, can also relate to other types of experiences that relate to initiation. Now, we talked about in there how Iris relates to peace as well as to death. And this concept of peace is one that definitely connects in with the idea of death. Sex is also something that relates to the idea of death as well as to initiation and magic. The orgasm in particular is referred to as the little death, which is a common way of referring to things in which something echoes something else in a way that teaches you about it or lets you know some part of its experience. In the Talmud, there are several things which... There are several things which are described as being 1/60th of something else. So sleep is 1/60th of death in the Talmud, meaning that sleep is like death, but not to the extremity which death is. Saying that orgasm is the little death is the same idea, that it's like death, but not to that same extremity. In the ways in which it kind of lines up with that, initially it's that you release yourself from certain types of tensions and bonds that would otherwise hold you. Now, there are definitely other tensions and bonds that go on when you experience orgasm, but it can be a way in which you strip away and detach yourself from all of the other things that would be typically affecting you and be beyond your control and beyond what it is that you are willing as a way of causing tension or binding yourself to things. The types of tensions and bonds that you're undergoing in this experience are all ones that you have chosen and willed and created for yourself. So you are taking on a certain level of mastery by removing yourself from all of these other things that would otherwise be affecting you. It can also be a method of creating that moment of stillness in which you begin to experience eternity. You can get a glimpse of what the kind of eternal state of being in an undifferentiated way is by reflecting on the experience undergone in orgasm when done correctly. Clearly not every time you experience this will you have these things, but if you do it in kind of a meditative way, or even just accidentally, you can get these things out of it. It can also be applied for magical initiatic experiences, because sex kind of relates to God. I mean, God, after all, is just basically a huge pool of sex, right? Like, everything being connected together, all is one thing, and the separations in it all obliterated. That's basically what sexual, not genital, means. So, but going beyond that, you can look at kind of the concepts of joy and connectivity. The ability to be connected to the divine is something that is joyous and ecstatic and overwhelming. Being connected to other people is the same experience, but often in a lesser fashion, until you start learning to experience God through those other people. So sex is a way in which you can experience an extreme level of connectivity with another person. So if you do that while reflecting on the divinity of that other person, you can find a very strong echo of the connection to God in that. You can look at your partner in that way almost as being a proxy for God. You can also, if you don't like your partner very much, look at it simply in the sense of balancing opposition, that you have two forces that are separate, but they're being brought together, and one represents the feminine polarity, one represents the masculine polarity, or one represents expansion, one represents contraction. You're balancing opposites in a way that creates this same experience that we talked about with creating the ingredient for the cake of light, or with combining the triangles and the hexagram. You basically are echoing that spiritual mechanic of combining two things together in a type of union where the differentiation that creates separateness is temporarily obliterated. Now, in terms of peace, well, you have Iris taking the souls of the dead to the underworld and being peace as well as being this undertaker. So mythologically, you have kind of a clear example of this idea that there's some relationship between peace and death. You also have Iris being the rainbow, which is basically the idea that despite having intense gloom and darkness, it's still going to be capped off by beauty in some way, which very much relates to the idea of death if you're looking at it as the entry to some sort of greater life, that even though it seems like this horrible, gloomy, sad thing, that it could be something that becomes wonderful. It goes in with the idea that once death is mastered, it's not something that's fearful. It's your way of releasing yourself from other trials, not in the sense of giving up and saying, okay, I'm just going to die and not deal with this, but in the sense that it ceases to be a trial because you're looking at it from a perspective in which you're able to deal with it, and it's generally irrelevant. It kind of also fits in with the idea of that experience of eternity through sex. You're basically experiencing a moment of peace, and it's the same peace that is derived from death. And this relationship of peace is also echoed in the Kabbalah, in that temperance follows death. And we're going to look at temperance, just like we looked at death a little bit later. to cap that off, though, basically the idea, like we've said a few times here, is that the real mystery is the immutability of the soul. And so death creates a sense of the stability of the soul as your source, but it doesn't actually reveal the soul itself. It reveals the immutable vessel that can hold the soul, but not the actual soul, because you're still dealing with material at that point once you're dealing with death. It primes the initiate for engaging the soul. So from this perspective, you don't have to deal with these things that are lower in a sense where they're on equal footing with you and can affect you. So you're able to start looking at things that are higher that would be affecting you. And the clearest higher effect is your soul. So since you were able to find, like, okay, there's this thing that's better than my material that can be me and is the actual thing that's unchanging, and you found that by killing the material, you have to kill the rest of the material in order to become that other thing. And so you basically have to destroy everything that remains in order to reveal the actual true essence at that point. So the decaying matter revealing the immutability of the soul has to be torn away in order to actually find the soul itself. And then you're able to see that that is what actually is the remaining immutable thing. The matter itself is simply the result of the application of that immutability. Once you recognize that the soul exists and that the light exists, you're able to tear away everything that's left of the veil and the shrine holding the veil in order to see into your soul directly. And that's why this is necessary in the process of preparing yourself for the Abramelin working. A good sort of mythological illustration of this is Christ on the cross. Everyone kind of talks about, like, well, the veil to the Holy of Holies was rended. So that which separated everyone from being able to enter in and experience God was destroyed in the process of Christ being crucified. But everything else in nature was torn to pieces in the process as well. So it wasn't just the veil being ripped apart. There's an earthquake, an eclipse. You have all kinds of craziness and destruction falling apart from this. So it still echoes the idea that you tear everything down in order to reveal what the actual truth is, so that the truth is the only thing that survives in the end. And that's pretty much it for death. So are there any questions on death and dying?
A couple of observations. Point of obliteration. Under the period of the Reich, there was a point where Hitler felt that the people had betrayed him, so he felt that they must be purified through the letting come to cataclysmic oblivion what had been in place. In many cases, it just seems like that's an extension of the serious mental illnesses. But when you bring it to that side, I guess he's reaching back to some of the Nordic myths that you're describing in the circle slide. So the people, thus folk, must be born again through the fire, purification of the fire. And the other thing I was thinking of when we discussed a little bit, purity of the essence in the 19th century, and in 20th century currently, the verb synonym number for ejaculation is to come. In the 19th century, it was to spin, and there was the consideration in the 19th century that was the divine intellectual essence. So those who were involved in art and writing made a big deal that they were going to abstain while they're working on a work. In fact, I think it was Honor Balzac was absolutely beside himself because he had a nocturnal emission that wiped out things. He said, "I've lost an entire masterpiece." It was fun. I remember reading that. And that was their period of abstinence for having the act is a period of ritual.
It definitely fits in with the idea that the more sperm you eat, the more like Jesus you become. Which, as a